Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Well, hello. Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bayer, and this is our 373rd episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, I have a special on-the-road show from Food on the Edge, which took place in Dublin, Ireland in October, and I was there participating as a speaker, and I will share more details in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start with my PR tip. Then later, we'll have a bunch of interviews I did at the symposium and close out with my solo dining experience. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to tell a good story. Share your personal experiences with others to inspire, educate, and entertain. Keep it real and in your voice and be authentically you. There isn't one way to tell a tale or style to be had. What matters is the truth told from the heart. So tell stories that are genuine, as storytelling is an art that can and will be appreciated. That's my tip today. Okay, so as I mentioned, today's show is all about Food on the Edge, which took place from October 16th to 17th in Dublin, Ireland. So what is Food on the Edge? Well, it's a two-day food symposium that brings together top international chefs and industry professionals, featuring about 50 speakers who are chosen for their innovation, passion, and influence on today's food culture. And I was really thrilled to be a part of it. It was my first time in Ireland. It was my first time attending this symposium, and I was there as a speaker doing a panel on my new book, Chefwise, Life Lessons from Leading Chefs Around the World by Fiden. And JP McMahon, who is the symposium director, is in my book, and he was on my panel and really the reason I was there. So thank you, JP. We'll get more into it in a moment, but it was really quite an honor to be on stage and to be a part of this fantastic symposium that took place at the Airfield Estate outside of the main hub of Dublin. And the theme was storytelling, hence my tip today. So that carried out throughout. It was two full days of programming with speakers who mostly gave kind of TEDx-style talks on different topics, and they were about 15 minutes each. My panel ended up being 30 minutes because there were many of us on stage, but it moved very quickly because it was a packed day of just lots of very interesting, dynamic speakers talking on different topics under the theme of storytelling and related to the culinary industry. The symposium also had some master classes going on, as well as a trade market component where they had different food and beverage vendors showcasing products. And they also had a bookstore where they were selling lots of the speakers' books, and my book Chefwise was there, and I signed copies for people, so that was awesome. And there was amazing food and drink throughout the day, from delicious bread and coffee and pastries in the morning and lunch. And we also had a speaker's dinner the night before, which was awesome. It was just perfectly executed. And I was, again, very honored to be a part of this conference, followed by 2 days of excursions, which was amazing. About 25 of us who were involved in the symposium took part in group activities together, which was planned by JP and his team. And it was amazing because, again, I hadn't been to Ireland or Dublin, and we got to see a lot of the area and do a lot of fun activities and bond. A really lovely country and really great people. As a part of our excursions, we went to Johnny Fox's pub, which is known to be the highest pub in Ireland. And it was fantastic. We had dinner there. We shucked oysters. There was music. It was a pretty large venue. There was a lot happening. And another highlight on the second day, we had lunch at a restaurant called Aqua, and we took a boat out onto the water. The sun came out right then, and it was lovely. And we closed it out at Old Street Restaurant and, you know, at this fun Irish pub in a different town called Malahide, which was very charming. I hope to get back at some point soon so I could see the rest of the countryside and get to Galway and visit JP's restaurant. You'll hear in my solo dining experience, I did have some wonderful meals in Dublin, which I will share later in the show. So thank you so much. Okay, so before I tell you who you're about to hear from, I'll just say a little about my panel, which again was on my book Chefwise, Life Lessons from Leading Chefs Around the World by Fiden and JP McMahon, who's the symposium director of Food on the Edge, is in my book, and he was on my panel, as well as Andoni Luis Adariz from Mugaritz in San Sebastian, Spain. I've seen him now a few times at different events. I went to Mugaritz back in 2013 and had a really special experience. And Andoni had an interpreter during our panel because he speaks Spanish. And so we mostly communicate through our eyes, I would say. But he's fantastic. And thank you to our interpreter who helped us out. The other panelists were Elena Regadas, who I've also seen quite a bit this year at different events. She is from Rosetta in Mexico City. And I've also been to her restaurant. I was there several years ago on a trip. And Elena was named Latin America's best female chef in 2014 by the world's 50 best. And that's amazing. And she's lovely. So thrilled to have her as a part of the panel. And finally, I got to meet Tala Bashmi, who's a chef from Fusions by Tala in Manama Baran in the Middle East. And she was awarded the best female chef by the MENA regional of the world's 50 best. And she received this in 2022. So it was amazing to meet her. And one day I hope to get to a restaurant. So those are my four panelists. Thank you all so much. It was a thrill to be there on stage with you and in front of the audience, which there was probably about a few hundred people under the tent and the airfield estate. Big congratulations to JP, Abigail, Julianne, all from the team, everyone involved. So thank you all so much. Now coming up, I have 8 interviews. Some are a few minutes long, some are a bit longer. Everybody introduces themselves as we start each conversation, so you'll know who I'm talking to. And also some of accents. So I spoke with amazing people. So first, Alessandro Cozzolino. He is the executive chef at La Loggia at Villa San Michele, a Belmont hotel in Florence, Italy. And I did a semester in Florence, or Firenze, back when I was in college. So have a place in my heart for Florence, and I can't wait to go back and go to his restaurant. Then I speak with Endo Kazutoshi, who is the chef at Endo at the Rotunda in London, which is an immersive omakase experience, which has a very limited amount of seats, and it sounds extraordinary, so I hope to get there one day. Then I speak with Rich Shi. He's the co-author of Koji Alchemy and is one of the key culinary explorers of mold-based fermentation in the United States. So you're going to hear about what he does a little bit. Then I speak with Tom Jenkins, and he is a British journalist and the managing editor of FineDiningLovers.com and San Pellegrino Young Chef Academy. So we have a nice conversation about what he's up to and his presentation, which is very cool. Then I speak with Arlene Stein, who moderated a few of the panels and has been involved in Food on the Edge for every year except one. And she is the founder and executive director of the Terroir Symposium in Canada. Then I speak with Andrea Petrini, who wears several hats. He's the road manager of Galinas, which we talk a lot about in our conversation, something I've taken part of. And he's also an incontinent writer, a food curator, an oblique strategist. He's a chair of the judging panel for the World's Restaurant Awards and a creative director at the European Food Summit. And he's done so much more. And our conversation is the longest one coming up. And we changed locations as well. So stay tuned for that. But it was really lovely to chat with him. And then I got to speak with Jason Bangeter, and he is the executive chef at the Langdon Hall Country House Hotel and Spa in Canada. And we had a really nice conversation and spent time together too on the excursions. It was nice to get to know him. And then finally, I wrap things up with a conversation with J.P. McMahon, who again is the symposium director of Food on the Edge. He's also the chef and owner of Aniar in Galway, Ireland, and the reason I was in Dublin. So that's what's coming up. I hope you enjoy all of my conversations, and then I will come back and share my solo dining experience and a lot of details also about where else I ate in Dublin, because as you know, I like to hop around when I'm traveling. So here you go. Here are my interviews from Food on the Edge in Dublin, Ireland from October 2023. Enjoy. Okay. So hello. Ciao.
Ciao.
So tell my listeners your name and Restaurante.
Okay. My name is Alessandro Cozzolino. I'm the executive chef of La Loggia Restaurant at Villa San Michele Belmont Hotel.
Which is in
Florence, in the region of Tuscany.
Yes. Yeah. Fantastic.
Food on the Edge for me, it's an opportunity to exchange and even hearing story from other colleagues, other producers. This is a huge opportunity to be in contact with each other, no? And especially in a land like Ireland that really believe on nature or and they are very proud of their soul about regarding food.
Your presentation was wonderful. The pasta looks so spectacular.
Thank
and
you.
Just perfect. And yeah, made me hungry for lunch. So you want to talk a little about what you're doing at your restaurant?
Yeah, La Loggia is a fine dining restaurant that respect and love the region of Tuscany. And all is made with my personality and the energy of my team. So it's all about what I feel feel in Florence, in Tuscany, and the way how we would like to talk between the food, and this is the main core of our lesson. So honest and genuinity of our land.
Amazing. Well, great. I told you earlier I studied in Florence back long time ago. It's one of my favorite cities in the world. I need to come visit you.
You sure come back.
For sure. One last question is, I have a new book out called Chef Wise, which is on chef advice. Do you have any top advice you would give someone who maybe wants to become a chef?
I think that you should just keep your dream solid and work hard. And I'm pretty sure that some days happen something good for all people that believe in what they really do, what they do. So it's a difficult job, but it's full of passion and emotions. So I think that everybody should keep inside this two things, emotion and passion, and we never forgot who they are, and go forward, go and work hard.
Amazing. Well, Thank you so much. To meet you, and
thank
look forward
you.
To seeing you.
See
in
you
Italy
in Florence.
Grazie.
Okay, my name is Kazutoshi Endo. Everybody called me Endo. So my restaurant is in London, called to Endo at the Rutanda in White City.
And what type of restaurant is it?
It's an omakase. It's a 10-seat, 2-seating, Tuesday to Friday. So 4 days, so we walk.
I love omakase. So when did you open, and what led you to open in London?
2019, April, actually, I opened a restaurant. But the reason why I live in London, because in 2007, I moved to London, come from Tokyo. So my job is executive group chef in Zuma. I opened Zuma, 7 Zuma, my boss together.
Did you open the Zuma Miami?
Yes, Miami as well, New York as well.
Okay,
yes.
I've been to both. Miami's my hometown.
Thank you very much. It's Miami is actually, I live in 1 year. New York is a year and a half. So.
Yeah, Miami, it's known to be a hot spot, a celebrity hot spot.
Absolutely, yes, exactly.
So I am actually heading to London after here. I don't know if I'm going to have time to come by your restaurant on this trip, but I definitely would love to visit.
Please.
How hard is it to get a reservation?
That's most difficult question.
Okay.
Because 2 months, one time, we opened a booking.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, our booking system is open 9 a.m., 2 months, one time, 3 minutes, sold out.
Really? Amazing.
Yes. It's now, many people say to me, it's a platinum ticket. So per day is 10 to seating, meaning 20 seat only.
And is it okay for me to ask how much your omakase is? In New York City, we have a lot of amazing sushi restaurants.
Right.
Omakase, and what falls under the more affordable sushi omakase is $100 or less.
Yeah.
And then we have, I don't know, over $500
maybe
now.
New York is like, you know, for example, my friend of mine, Sushi Nozi,
mm-hmm.
in New York, is the Upper East Side, is like more expensive.
Nas? Yeah, I've been there. Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. So my restaurant is £250 plus 15% service charge.
Okay.
So probably per head is £350 per head. So
yeah,
that's 20 courses.
Do you think there is many? I want to say competition, or compared to New York, as I said, so many choices, which I feel lucky because I love omakase. But in London, how
now getting more competition
uh-huh.
is competitive.
Yeah,
a lot of competition. But New York and London, New York is so much different because London is more, history is longer, the Japanese sushi scene. The second thing is now London is more popular, maybe 2-3 years. Maybe today I explained to you about Japanese sushi scene in London.
Mm-hmm.
5 years ago, I opened a restaurant. Omakase included me only 3.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then now maybe 40.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 50, like only yeah. just 5 years. It's a lot of omakase restaurants opening.
Yes. Yeah. And I mentioned to you when we were off air that I did the opening of Sushi Ishikawa
yeah.
in New York City with yeah. Chef Don yeah. Pham, who you know.
I opened Zuma New York. He's there.
Yeah.
Then I showed to him it's a lot of things he say as a totally unique. So it maybe New York is maybe 3 times a week. Is you got easy to find the Japanese produce. But London is zero. Mm-hmm. That's why 100% we're using local produce.
Yeah.
For example, for me, English produce is 90%.
Mm.
That's a very important engaged with producer. Also yeah. supplier as well.
It's about the relationship.
Exactly.
Because the product is, I mean, it's important in any
Absolutely.
Cuisine, but I
Absolutely.
Feel in Japanese
it is.
Cuisine, what you do, it's like, it's everything,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're here at the Food on the Edge conference in Dublin, Ireland. Is this your first time here?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. So what brought you here?
Yeah, that's good. You know, it's cold today, but...
cold, crisp yeah, Irish air.
It is, but Guinness is nice. But tomorrow I go to Wasa Michelin restaurant in Dublin. So maybe
yeah.
I don't know much about
Yeah, me too,
Irish
but I've been starting to dive into it and learn more.
Yeah. yeah.
yeah. So... you spoke earlier today. What was the theme of your talk?
About my career, of course. But actually, I born a sushi restaurant. That's why sushi is it's not my job. It's mm-hmm. kind of my life, the purpose of my life. So that's why I really, really happy to introduce our culture-wise. Also, now omakase is in the world kind of wild standard about Japanese restaurant. It's omakase equal Japanese restaurant. So maybe not much people know understanding about omakase. That's why today I'm really happy to little bit more advice.
Yeah.
Also kind of introduce about omakase spirit. The spirit is like very important for Japanese sushi chef, I think.
Yes. Well, your presentation was wonderful.
Oh,
with
thank
your,
you.
The photos were very appealing.
Yeah.
And I do think, yeah, I agree. I think omakase has become more mainstream and more popular. Well, thank you so much.
No,
it's
thank
so
you
nice
very much.
To meet
nice
you.
To meet you.
And
I really hope to see you in my restaurant too.
Yes, I will let you know. We'll stay in touch. And please
yeah.
let me know when you're in New York City so I can... send you places.
Yes, please. That does
maybe,
interesting too.
Maybe meet up with you and we can go out for sushi together and I'll see what you think.
Yeah, why not?
All right. Well, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
My name's Rich Shi. I actually don't have a restaurant.
Okay.
I'm a fermentation educator and I focus on koji, which is the driver for essentially most Asian condiments and alcohols. And I'm just excited about it because there are a multitude of applications for any cuisine, any cooking level in terms of your experience to make more delicious food.
Where are you based?
I'm based just north of Boston, so I spend a lot of time in Boston.
And how did you get into what you're doing now?
When I got out of college, I just didn't... I really like to eat, and going out to eat was really expensive. So I just learned how to cook, and then eventually I connected with a lot of chefs because of my technical knowledge as a mechanical engineer. And then a chef asked me to make some koji for a brunch that he was doing, and then it sort of planted the seed for me to try a lot of different things that nobody had been trying before with koji.
Amazing. Well, what brings you to Food on the Edge?
JP invited me because I had been working with his kitchen staff on how to do things interesting and delicious with Irish ingredients. And he felt that it would be applicable to other people to be able to use this ingredient to expand their, you know, repertoire of using enzymes in the kitchen.
Well, thank you so much. So nice to meet you.
Yeah, same here. Thank you so much.
My name is Tom Jenkins. I'm the managing editor of FineDiningLovers.com and also the San Pellegrino Young Chef Academy. So I'm here at Food on the Edge. I did a talk here about AI and food journalism. I'm also going to do a panel regarding the San Pellegrino Young Chef Academy, which is a kind of a community that was born out of the San Pellegrino Young Chef Academy competition, which is all about kind of nurturing young chefs and helping them progress in their careers.
I've known your name and Fine Dining Lovers website for a long time and the San Pellegrino Young Chef competition. So how did you get involved? I mean, I've been watching from the outside and seeing both of them progress. So first with Fine Dining Lovers, how did you get involved with that?
In a personal sense, so I'm based in London. I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for over a decade now. Had always had a strong interest in food, had done some writing about food amongst kind of other subjects, and then ended up I found myself applying for a role at Fine Dining Lovers, which is based in Milan. So I moved over there for 2.5 years.
Oh, nice.
To Milan to work for Fine Dining Lovers. I'm now back in London, but I work remotely for them from London. And the San Pellegrino Young Chef Academy project, I mean, this is something that started in 2020. The competition itself has been going since 2015, and the Academy was started in 2020 just as a way to kind of continue that good work of the competition. So the competition, although it is a cooking contest, the kind of strongest things that come out of that competition are the networking, the connection between young chefs and their peers, but also young chefs and some of the biggest names in the world of gastronomy, and also the kind of all the things they learn, the mentoring relationships that they have during that competition. So the Academy exists as a way to continue that good work, in, you know, before, after, during the competitions. Personally, I kind of, the good thing about working across those two projects is I kind of get to see, someone described it as both sides of the pass, right? So, you know, Fine Dining Lovers, we're very consumer focused now. So my interest in that and who I speak to is the consumer, is the diner, is the foodie. But on the Academy project, I get to go deep into the more industry side of the world and work with and meet a lot of very, very talented young chefs. I think, as I was telling you earlier, some of them, they're incredibly young and the stuff they're doing, you know, I wish I could have been as good at something at that young age as they are at cooking.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And I told you earlier, I went to the regional in New York and you just had the competition in Milan. Mm-hmm. How was that? Is it attended by consumers or is it an all industry event?
Yeah, it's not. It's mainly industry. It's not open to the public. So you'll have industry, you have media. There is some partners of San Pellegrino and Aquapana. There will be some influencers there as well. Some other big names in the food world, some, you know, chefs who have maybe been involved in the competition before or who are interested in the competition. We had Massimo Bottura speaking at one point, and his team from a few of his different restaurants cooked the gala dinner. In terms of the event itself, it was great, and there's such an amount of positivity coming out of those kitchens when the competition's in full flow. Like, obviously everyone is super focused and, you know, stressed to a point and needs to get their 5 hours to cook this signature dish, right, for a grand jury of, like, some of the world's best chefs.
So a bunch of them are in my ChefWise book.
Yeah, yeah.
We have that crossover.
Yeah.
Yeah, your judging panel was
absolutely
extraordinary.
Yeah, we had a great panel this year. Unfortunately, kind of last minute, two of the grand jurors had to drop out for personal reasons. But we had Nancy Silverton, we had Riccardo Caminini, we had Vicky Lau, And then we also had Pierre Leon and Hendra Ross. They're fantastic chefs.
Yeah.
And they are highly experienced, and they are perfectly placed to kind of spot this kind of talent.
Right.
It's what they do on, you know, on a daily basis. It's how they've got to where they are, not just through extreme hard work, but also the ability to spot talent and nurture it so that they can then delegate, you know, properly in their own kitchens. So, as I was saying, the great thing that came out of it was, even though all of these young chefs and their mentors are working at 100 miles an hour to get this signature dish out for the judges, the collaboration between the kitchens, like, you know, people are helping each other out, people are hyping each other up, you know, people are jumping in to, like, help serve the dishes if there's a few different elements. And as I was just saying to you, this is some of the strongest points about the competition, is it's not just the winning of it, it's the people you meet. It's
mm-hmm.
A lot of these young chefs make friendships for life. They get, I know plenty of chefs who've got, you know, professional opportunities from this. They're collaborating with their peers all over the world, doing four hands dinners. It opens up a lot of doors. And I think that networking, that connection is the strong point of the competition.
It's a really amazing competition for all those reasons and more. But speaking of the winner, who did take away the prize this year?
So it was a young chef from Portugal called Nelson Freitas.
Okay.
So he is a junior sous at a restaurant called 50 Seconds in Lisbon. He did a dish of, it's like a crispy, I can't remember the name of the fish, but it was like a crispy skinned fish. And there was like a sea urchin on the side. And by all accounts, like, everything was there. Like, taste was there, technique was there, but also the story behind the dish. The chef was very much highlighting his heritage and the kind of the produce of his region. And I think he ticked all the boxes. And I think the grand jurors were really, really impressed.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll be seeing more amazing things from him.
Look out for him, yeah.
That's awesome. And with fine dining lovers, how do you decide what content that you're covering? Are you covering chefs and restaurants all around the world?
Yeah, so the way it works is we have finedininglovers.com, which is the English language site. And we also have French, Spanish, and Italian language sites.
Okay.
So
it's different content.
Well, it's about 50-50.
Okay.
So we have about half of our content is what we call global content. So that's content that is published across the four platforms. And then kind of the other half is what we call local content. So that is content that is more of interest to the particular regions for those platforms. So for .com, which is, I'm the managing editor of that platform, we're very much focused on the UK, US and Canada, but we also obviously have an international interest as well. So, you know, we'll talk about anywhere essentially, whereas something like the Italian language site will be more focused on Italy. The Spanish language site is more focused on Spain, Latin America and France on France for its more local content.
Amazing. So, one last question mm-hmm. before we get back to the conference. We are here at Food on the Edge, and you gave a really wonderful talk yesterday on AI. So talk a little about that. Why was that your subject, and why do you think it's important for us to be focusing on that here?
Thank you, first of all. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I really did.
It's a really big subject to condense into 15 minutes. I think when the JP announced that the subject for Food on the Edge this year was storytelling. I think this is a very, very pertinent subject in terms of being a journalist and in terms of what stories mean how much value they have. It's obviously, as a journalist, the idea of generative AI. Is something that we're all thinking about. Of course, it is a threat. Many journalists will see it as a threat to their livelihoods. And I also wanted to kind of produce, I wanted to give a balanced view of it. It's something that can be a useful tool for us, but obviously none of us really knows what's going to happen in the future and how much we are going to become, let's say, redundant as journalists because of this technology. But it fundamentally, shall we say, impacts our ability as journalists to tell stories. And I think that was why it was so pertinent. But as I said, it's a big subject and it's difficult to condense that down to 15 minutes. I think the overall outcome that I wanted to kind of stress is that we don't really know where what's going to happen with it, but maybe there is a kind of slight light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the possibility that this could eventually have a positive in turning people back towards more trusted sources, higher quality content, content with more value. Hopefully that content isn't, as I was saying yesterday, it doesn't become fetishized, it doesn't become a kind of collectible for nostalgias, right? But maybe that the kind of content soup that exists on the internet will become so, let's say, diluted by all of this AI-generated content that people, it gets to the point where people don't really know what to believe anymore. And then maybe a positive outcome of that could be that people start to turn back to more trusted sources. But as I said, we'll have to wait and see.
To be continued.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it was a really great talk. And I think, yeah, we're going to be hearing or reading more of it.
It's difficult to keep up with it. Yeah. This is the thing. It's
I know.
It's every day we see more and more stories about it, and not just the generative AI that I talked about in regards to my profession, but the bigger existential threat of it. There's a lot of obvious and understandable doom mongering around it. So it's hard to be honest, it's hard to keep up with the development of that technology and how it's going to affect all our lives. And yeah, we don't know if the companies, the people behind this technology necessarily are able to keep up with its development too. So,
Yeah, we'll see. No, I think it's really, really great that you spoke about that. I didn't know what you were speaking about when you got on stage, and I was like, oh, this is very interesting and cool to be a part of this conversation that we're having here about the industry and about food and about storytelling, and we shall see what the future brings. But you're on it. It's just a good reminder to me to also be paying more attention to what is happening, because it is going to change our lives.
Yeah.
There's
a lot of
the way we do work.
There's a lot of noise out there, so it can be hard to kind of see through all that. But as I said, hopefully I was able to give like an overview and a kind of intro to the subject.
You did. You did awesome. And congratulations on everything that you're doing with your businesses, with your travels, with supporting chefs in the industry and restaurants. And it's really great to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
My name is Arlene Stein, and I run a company called Terroir Hospitality, and we do projects and programs where we bring together people working in the world of restaurants and hospitality, namely chefs, sommeliers, artisanal food producers, and we try to create an interesting program that's around inspiration and also talk about, food systems issues.
When did you start your company? And I believe you're from Canada, but you're living now in Berlin, a little bird told me.
Yeah. So I started in 2007 in Toronto. The main symposium, which has been running for 17 years now, is now in Calgary. That happens once a year. I've been living in Berlin for 10 years now. And in that time, we've done projects all over Europe. And so again, because we've built such a great network of interesting people, we always sort of lean on relationships that we've developed through the symposium to look at doing interesting projects in other places.
So I've heard about your symposium,
terroir. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
I always get tongue-tied on that word. And you just had one recently, a couple weeks ago. So was there a theme for it this year?
Yeah, every year we create a new theme depending on what's sort of topical for that year or something that we think will bring inspiration. And we try to tie all of the people that we're inviting to that theme. So this year was about transformation. We'd spent a couple of years obviously talking about COVID and rebuilding and restructuring and rethinking. And we really wanted to do something that was more aspirational. And so transformation for us was sort of like, you know, the birth of the phoenix out of the ashes and sort of like, you know, where this industry is going, because we still continue to experience a lot of hardships. And it's like, we want people to be excited about this industry and be committed to it because we want to be able to retain people and get people excited and passionate again about what they're doing. And at the end of it, you know, people are passionate about hospitality because they get to connect with people and create relationships. And let's face it, feeding people and bringing people into a restaurant around food is about celebration. It's about love. It's about caring. It's about hospitality. It's about community. So, you know, we fundamentally believe in that. And that's what we want to do when we create our own community and bring them together under these topics.
Yeah, 100%. Bringing people together is so important. And so that brings to us being here right now at Food on the Edge in Dublin. So you've participated in this event in the past?
Every year except for one. Yeah. So,
and that wasn't, well, there were pandemic years. I think they skipped it, but yeah. Okay. So you missed one. Well, that's a pretty good track record.
Yeah. Yeah. So I met JP, he mentioned on stage, Fáilte Ireland put together a culinary tourism strategy. And part of that was creating what they called Irish food ambassadors. And they selected people from each of the provinces, I believe, across Ireland. And the intent was to celebrate them, but also to bring awareness to Irish food products through these people. And one of the activities was to do a best practice mission in Canada. My friend who was helping me with Terroir at the time runs a culinary tourism agency. And so she led this best practice mission and took them to sort of, you know, places that were already developmentally ready for culinary tourism in Ontario. And that's how I met JP and a host of other people that are here. And then Fáilte Ireland brought a few of us back to do a best practice mission when they were opening the Wild Atlantic Way. And we talked to various stakeholders along that path, who were doing food businesses, food enterprises, food restaurants. And we basically just shared our stories and shared the support of how we created the things that we do. And that's where JP and I had the conversation about, you know, what we were doing with Terroir. We invited him to Terroir, and it was sort of not the model that he created Food on the Edge for, but definitively, I think he would say it was an inspiration for what he did with Food on the Edge.
I did a conference right before the pandemic called Host.
Yeah.
And so I know now what it takes to do a conference. Mine was a day. It's amazing to bring people together, and the fact that you have been involved almost every year. So what I'm gathering, though, is as you're involved, you then get more responsibility because you moderated, were involved in many of the panels. So you want to talk a little about the different ones that you did?
Yeah. I mean, so with getting, you know, sort of, I would say, roped in this year. I've been.
You said it. I didn't.
I was going to come just as a guest. I've come in the past to speak, to actually do a talk a few times. I was the MC last year, actually, for one of the days.
Nice.
And I've in various years moderated other panels. Again, this year I was meant to come as a guest, and then at the last minute, Abigail said, you know, we've got a panel we need you to moderate. And then that turned into two other panels, which is fine because actually I love moderating panels and I think I'm pretty decent at it. I just love sharing people's stories. I really, really like people. I mean, I know that sounds corny, but it's one of the things that makes me thrive in the business that I'm in, and helping people to connect is something that I get really excited about. Helping people build relationships. It's why I started my program of Terroir. So I'm equally as excited about this because I think that JP and Abigail and their team, like over the years, we've created a much stronger unity. Also, there's like people on the periphery of that have also come to Food on the Edge many, many times. Richard, who does photography, who's become a friend. He was just in Toronto for our program. both JP and Abigail came for our program. And like, I can only hope that we will continue to make those ties stronger. We also did, which most people don't know about, together, collectively, a small program in Milan in January. No, sorry, it was in March. So we did a combination collaborative with Dennis Pizza and Collectibus, JP's team from Food on the Edge, and then my team from Terroir. And we did like a mini workshop / forum along with a learning journey. So yeah, so there's other projects we can work on as well that are really interesting.
Well, it's so nice to meet you, and perhaps we'll be able to work together too, a little New York connection at some point.
Yes, I would love that. That would be amazing. I love New York. I just got back from New York.
All right. Well, next time, let me know, and we'll go out to eat. Okay, so thank you.
Thank you, Sherry.
Ciao.
Ciao. My name is Andrea Petrini, and I'm a journalist, a writer, an organizer, and I work, I would say, for myself. I work for my readers. I write for several magazines in France, Italy, the US. Believe it or not, even in South Korea. Maybe one day I will even go to North Korea.
Ah.
I don't know. It was a joke. But yeah. Yeah.
So I've known of you for a while, just from someone in the industry who follows the industry, participates in a lot of events. And one of the things you've been involved with is Galinas. Yeah. And they used to call it the Galina Shuffle, but just Galinas. But talk a bit about that, because I've gone to several of your dinners in New York or the Shuffle and was fascinated by the concept. So how did you come up with Galinas?
Okay, it goes back nearly to 20 years ago. We were in, there was a festival coming up, and a very famous Italian chef was had been asked to go on stage and do the usual show cooking kind of stuff. And he never wanted to go, he never went. And that would have been the fifth or the sixth time, the sixth year that he would have refused to go. So I was holidaying not far from his restaurant. One day he says, hey, I need a good excuse for not going again, or eventually a good idea to go, but to do something completely different. And this guy, Fulvio Pierangelini, was obsessed by the idea that everybody wanted to copy his recipes. And in fact, he never released a book of himself with recipes. And that night, by chance, I don't know if it was a chance, I had insomnia, I couldn't sleep, and at a certain moment I had this image like Holy Mary, Mother of God, of Fulvio on stage doing cooking a recipe, and at the same time, four or five other chefs around him cooking, doing the same recipe, but in a different version, like the Matrix and the Remix. It was nothing revolutionary. I mean, in music, it happens all the time when a rock band does a reprise of a famous song by Bob Dylan. In jazz, when a famous musician does a cover of an old standard. In electronic music, when you remix someone else's thing. So there was nothing new, nothing. I couldn't win the Oscar for innovation or for whatever. It was just that it had never been applied to cooking, to cuisine. And so he accepted. We gathered a few friends for the first edition. There was Massimo Bottura, Peter Nilsson, Andoni, Luisa Duriz, and then little by little, other people arrived, René Redzepi, Inaki Spitarte, Kobe Destramult, Wally Dufresne from New York. And we try every kind of year to do either an event or a series of events, but it's something completely out of the box. It's not in the least thing mainstream. We want it to be every year different, unexpected, in order to explore new territories, to be a challenge. And if chefs, even big chefs, accept to be part of it, it's because it's It's a family gathering where they can be outside the restaurant, outside their comfort zone, taking risks. They are not asked to reproduce the same perfection of cuisine, the same level of cuisine. We wouldn't care. You don't ask a big chef to come and be and do something identical to what he does every day. You want it to push him further and to see how far he can go, to exchange ideas, share intuitions. It's an experimental playground, and every time it's kind of different. And for example, the shuffle, which was not even an idea of mine, we were doing in 2014, we were doing what we call the spiritual retreat in Tuscany. So there was, we were, 25 chefs. That July, there was Virgilio Martinez, Rodolfo Guzman, Fulvio Perangelini, Massimo Bottura, Anna Ross, Kobe Desramult, Agatha Felluga. And we were trying to discuss what do we want to do next without having to go on our knees and plead and ask for money to the big sponsors that they only want to place their products. They don't have, they're not interested exactly in what you do. They just see you as a pretext, as an opportunity to place whatever they want. And so, since we wanted to do something completely out of control from the exterior, we were exploring new ideas. And at a certain point, Blaine Wetzel, a young chef that came out from Noma, and he used to be on Lumi Island, not far from from
Seattle.
From Seattle. He came and said, hey, I have a little idea, and he spread out on the floor an atlas, like a world atlas, and we could see arrows going from New York to Kyoto, from Sao Paulo to Berlin. And he said, hey, what the heck is that? He said, that could be the shuffle. I mean, what if we do it randomly? We pick up names, and if it's my name and it comes with a destination, I go to that place, and the guy from that place goes somewhere mm-hmm. else, and then when we reach our destination, we stay there for a few days, we cook their way, we cook in that restaurant with the produces that they use, with the team in the kitchen. We do a mix of that restaurant as it is seen from our own personalities. We do a shuffle. And then, even because we were penniless, we said, okay, and you know what? We don't have the money to pay for the hotels for 5 days. So when you go, you stay in the house of the chef that is hosting, because he's not going to be there. He will be on the other side of the world, so you can swap flats. And it was a bit like living in a reality show, live my life for mm-hmm. 5 days. And that thing was meant, that happened in 2015, it was meant to happen once, it was meant to be a one-shot, the shuffle, but it had a huge success, and even the chefs started saying, ah, it was so fun, so exciting, we should do it again. A lot of people started to complain, we didn't know when we tried to get the tickets, it was too late, they had already been completely sold, you should do it again. So we did it again in 2016. Then we did other stuff. And then in 2018, we felt that the world had changed, that we had created the little monsters. Chefs had become the new messiahs. They had been spending more time in between two flights, going from the restaurant to a congress, from the congress to a master class, from the master class to a foreign dinner for a pop-up, etc., etc. I've been spending actually more time outside their restaurants than in their own place. And also it's just for the ego. I mean, it's Chef Andy going to Tokyo. Oh, welcome, Chef Andy. When I'm there, it's my team that is working for me in my restaurant. If you see what I mean. And so in 2018, we changed completely. We did the shuffle. We exchanged the recipes. I mean, every chef created the menu. Mm-hmm. But the chefs didn't travel. What did travel were the menus, the recipes, were the ideas. And we called that thing the stay-in tour, meaning that if that night you booked to go to Noma, you were 100% sure that René Redzepi was there, will be there.
Right.
But he won't be cooking his own cuisine 100%, but the remix of someone else's ideas crossed with his own. And that was even more complicated to understand.
Interesting. I do, yeah. But let me just share with you, though, my experience and why, I hear you on, you know, you talk about maybe it was just for the chef or the ego, but as a participant, as an industry enthusiast, in 2015, I went to the World Expo in Milan and took a train down to Modena by myself. I traveled up by myself, had a solo lunch at Osteria Francescana, met Massimo. He sent me home with Parmesan cheese, and that's how I met him. And invited me in the kitchen to talk. The shuffle was coming up a month later. I found out he was coming to New York.
Yeah.
To cook at Momofuku Ko.
Yeah.
And I had a ticket to go to Momofuku. I had a ticket to that dinner. So a month after my lunch at Osteria Francescana, I then enjoyed Massimo's food in New York at Ko. And as you said, like he did, it was a different menu. He did his like signature, what's the drop on the plate?
Dropped the lemon tart.
The lemon tart. He did that, but he did like a, it was like a different version of that because, as you said, like they did different dishes. So I would imagine I'm the only person in the world probably to have two solo back-to-back experiences like that. And that's how I got to know Massimo. And I have this new book out called Chef Wise, and a bunch of the chefs you named are in my book from my travels and meeting them.
Yeah.
So Massimo's in my book, and that was really how our relationship started. And then 2016, I went to the dinner with Manu Bufara, who she was matched with Torst in Brooklyn. Do you remember that?
Yes.
So, and I was at the chef's counter and I met Manu then, and she's also my Chef Wise book. So when I was putting my book together and figuring out who to ask to be in it, a lot of it was based on my experiences and relationships. So that, I had met Manu. I haven't been to her restaurant in Brazil, but it came from that. So thank you. Thank you. Man. My point of all that is you were a part, without realizing it, to my book, my career, my relationships. That's my story with your program. So thank you.
Thanks to you. Anytime.
So now in 2023, what's the status?
In 2023, the shuffle, the first one, the second one, the one we did with the staying tour, then the silent voices when we did this shuffle of ideas, and it happened all around the world, but only in those places that were allowed to be open during the pandemic. Gelinas became gigantic. It was maybe a bit too spectacular for my taste. People were expecting, it's going to be Bottura, it's going to be Redzepi coming to cook in my little neighborhood restaurant.
Pressure.
And then I realized that I wanted it to be even more daring, even more experimental. And if there is something that 95% of the chefs actually don't give a shit, is the music. Or the music. If you are unlucky enough and you go to dine and spend your money in a European three Michelin star restaurant, you might end up dining while listening to Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons. It's peep, 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 peep. If you go to New York into a hip place, you might feel you are at a heavy metal concert. But again, it's music just used to occupy the space, to fill up the space. Maybe it's the Spotify list of the chef, or maybe it's the selection of the pastry chef. There's no real investigation. But what could happen if a chef asks a composer with a capital C, a musician with a capital M, or a performer with a capital P, someone who is into food, someone who knows his restaurant or a restaurant, someone who understands the space, the ideas, the philosophy of the food, the acoustics, what would happen if that musician composes a score, might be classical music, might be an improvised music, might be whatever, expressly for that restaurant. Something to go with the food, something to go with the pace, to go even against the pace, to slow down, to accelerate the pace, to suggest other things. Not like the music that you hear when you go and see a blockbuster, to underline, now you are supposed to laugh, now you are supposed to scream because it is a scary beat, something much more subtle. An extra element that would add another perspective to the whole thing. And most of the chefs don't get it. They get their free controls, they want everything to be perfect, the lights, the chairs, the storytelling, the service, the one list. But music or the sonic identity, we could say, of the space, it's the last thing they would spend time thinking about. And so we have started this thing called the Digelinas, no BGM now, no background music. And chefs are asked to find their soulmate, their preferred composer or friend composer, and do something together, something to be played in the restaurants for at least a couple of nights, to be recorded and then played in the restaurant for a limited period of time. Pushing that sort of collaboration between two different languages. And as much as the chefs, they find it hard to understand, musicians, they get it immediately. And so it can be, it's gonna result in a different series of performances with a monthly rhythm. The first one was in the French Alps with Guillaume Monjuret and a folk ambient composer. The second one was incredible just 10 days ago in Biarritz. Mathieu Rostron, a young chef who has been collaborating with David Chalman. Chalman is a classical trained musician. He's also part of the Dream House Quartet, a contemporary music quartet composed of two pianos and two guitars. He's one of the guitar players, and the other one is Bryce Destner from The National. And they did a thing outside the restaurant in a field that lasted 4 hours. People, when people arrived, they were provided headphones and chairs to lay in the sun. And the food, it was not like a menu of dishes, but like little experiments different variations around the same product, squid, raw, cooked, squeezed, fermented with black ink. And it went with this circular, noisy, melodic, iterative music made with a modular synthesizer.
Very cool. Sign me up. When's the next one?
The next one is going to be the 20, and it's going to be totally different. It's going to be in a brasserie, in a chic brasserie in Munich, in Germany. It will be three chefs, three Austrian chefs, playing with different artists from the same techno label. The one after that will be, believe it or not, in Ukraine.
I thought you were going to say New York City.
No, in Ukraine, in Ukraine. With these new experiences of music, with different performances, different scales, different formats, different atmospheres. Some might be more classic, like the one we had in July with Guillaume Monjuret and the French composer H. Banz, something much more experimental, something more technoided. And I'm waiting for Massimo Bottura to do his own, which should be something happening inside the Abbey Road Studios in London.
Fantastic. Stay tuned for that.
Stay tuned for that.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about what brought you here to Food on the Edge in Ireland. Have you been to this symposium before?
I've been to Food on the Edge in 2017 as part of the audience, but I have a special relationship for Ireland, which is a country that I really love. And even a couple of decades ago, more than a couple of decades, let's say 30 years ago, I was even seriously considering the idea of moving to Ireland, because in those days, it was just the beginning of what we called the Celtic Tiger. But for me, Ireland was almost a pre-capitalistic country. It was a space of its own with huge, warm, welcoming from all the people. There was a huge curiosity, and in the country you could feel still the class differences, but everything merged in a sort of community feeling, in a sort of we are all together, we are all in it together, in a sort of proudness or pride for their culture, their roots, but also the desire to be 100% active actors in the European community. It was an exciting place. So I have friends in Ireland. I come now and then, not as much as I want, but I love this country.
So your talk at the conference, you want to just tell us a little what the theme?
The theme was storytelling, which for me was the most terrible thing that happened in cuisine, but also in movies, in literature. Storytelling is a shortcut, it's a way to pitch, to make everybody understand. It lacks the poetry, it lacks the mystery, it's become something pedantic, pedagogic, etc. But since 50 minutes it's not enough to go deep, I need to do a sort of stand-up. And I tried to put ideas down, how to talk about this storytelling. And for me, the best way was first to find the good title and then to move from that. So it was a sort of talk, a work in progress on the way that I was approaching the idea of the storytelling.
Well, amazing. It's so nice to chat with you, to meet you. And I can't wait to see and be a part of anything you do next, because I know it will be exciting, whatever it is.
It's coming to New York in 2024.
Okay. Let me know if I can do anything to help.
I will.
Thank you.
Thanks to you.
Thank you. Grazie mille.
Oh, my pleasure.
My name is Jason Bangeter. I'm the chef at a Relais Chateau boutique hotel and spa named Langdon Hall in Cambridge, Ontario.
When did you become the chef there?
I actually just celebrated my 10-year anniversary.
Ooh,
so 10 years ago, last week. And I've been there ever since, and I love it. And it's been a really great opportunity for me. It's I call it the chef's dream. It is a playground. It 75 acres, wild ingredients, our own gardens, really close to nature and farms in the area. And every single day I feel inspired by the place.
And you're involved with Relais Chateau?
Yeah, so we're one of 13 Relais Chateau properties in Canada. And I sit on the World Culinary Council with Relais Chateau, representing the Canadian culinary team.
And so that involves you traveling around the world to Relais Chateau properties?
Well, it involves, yes, absolutely.
Lucky you.
It's pretty special. But I'm very humbled by the opportunity to network and work so closely with like-minded chefs and chefs that are in great properties that are doing, you know, great work to better the industry and better the planet and food. I think, I'm lucky enough to sit on a council where we have a meeting in North America where our delegates get together in North America once a year, and we do a world meeting with the World Culinary Council members once a year. And it's an opportunity to really look at how we can work together as a team and have some impact through making good choices and best practices around things like sustainable seafood choices and enriching the biodiversity in our regions and our countries, and focusing on supporting local economy through getting ingredients from farms in our areas and supporting those artisanal small production artisans.
Amazing. And you had mentioned to me that Mauro Colagreco was your colleague in this.
Yeah, so he's actually the vice chair of Relais Chateau for culinary. So he's at the top.
I'm calling him a colleague.
He sits at the top of the, the culinary section for Relais Chateau.
He
just actually came on. Previously it was Olivier Rollinger.
Okay.
And so he's just jumped into the driver's seat, and we're all very excited to be working with him on these initiatives that Relais Chateau is pushing forward.
Yeah, that's very exciting. As you know, he's in my ChefWise book, and I've been to his amazing restaurant, Marizer, and he's wonderful. So that's
yeah, we were just terrific. There. It's fantastic.
So we met here at Food on the Edge in Dublin, Ireland. So what brought you here this year?
Well, I think representing Relais Chateau, working with another Relais Chateau chef here in Ireland, to sit on a panel and talk about exactly that. They talk about specifically sourcing sustainable seafood, and every year we work on something different. It's whether it's picking a lesser known species or something that takes pressure off of the more common species. So one year we did seaweed, one year we did bivalves. This year we're talking about seasonality and the word seasonality and how it can be tricky because people think because something's in season that it's an ethical choice. And what we're asking people to do is look a little deeper and start thinking about stock levels of species, because it's in season doesn't mean that it's actually in a healthy stock level. So we just need to be looking at those stock levels that are flourishing and eat those species and let the species that need a bit more time to recover and to regenerate to give them that opportunity.
Fantastic. Well, your talk was really great, and it's been so wonderful to meet you and be on 2 days of excursions as well throughout Dublin.
Yeah.
And so I look forward to visiting you one day, hopefully, Canada.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, your property sounds
it's awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So,
I'd love to show you around, and I'd love to cook for you. Because we had I'd love to cook for you conversation. And, I think we've been really blessed. We've been lucky to hang out together, and it's actually not been all rainy and cold. We've had some sunshine, and we've shared some special moments. So thanks.
Thank you.
And thank you. And thank you for this interview.
Oh, my pleasure.
Congratulations on your book.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, great to meet you, and I'll see you somewhere hopefully in the near future.
I'm sure.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Because Mahon is the Irish, is an Irish name, and then they put in Mac, but McMahon is more, I'd say, English in Boston.
Okay, so
McMahon.
Hello, J.P. McMahon.
Yes.
McMahon.
McMahon. No, McMahon.
J.P. McMahon.
McMahon.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm very good.
Wow. Food on the Edge in Dublin, Ireland, where we've been for the past couple of days. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's been spectacular to be here. Let's go back a little bit and tell me about what inspired you to create this two-day symposium.
I think this is its eighth rendition. I suppose we missed one for COVID. And I was inspired around 2013 and 2014 from going to similar conferences and similar symposiums and events around the world, in Canada, Europe, America, in Mexico. And I suppose I realized that I was thinking, why don't we do something like this in Ireland? I was thinking, do you know what, we have really good produce. And I suppose I was part of a collection of chefs who kind of came to maturity around the late noughties, early 2010s, and I felt that Irish food culture was gaining more momentum, and so I wanted to bring some of the world's best chefs to Galway, and that was the original sales pitch, was to bring the world's best chefs. And if you saw from this year's Food on the Edge, the brief has changed and grown out to a much wider brief, but at the very beginning it was that. And I suppose I started contacting these chefs via social media or through the restaurants, and everyone said I was mad and they wouldn't come because they said, sure, why would they come to Ireland? There's nothing in Ireland. But I suppose I had felt from even working with some of the chefs when we were in Mexico or we were in Charleston or in South Carolina, I had felt that, you know, like the Irish produce is really, really good. And I think we do have a food culture. It's just quite understated, maybe more humble or modest. And I think there is something there to tell people, and I think people would be interested. And that has been going now 8 years, and we have grown into be very much interested in all aspects of the food business, from chefs to restaurateurs to food writers and journalists and food policy people. And really it's a smorgasbord of everything about food for 2 days, through the format of little talks for 15 minutes or panels for 20. And it's like a big think tank for the industry, I think, and a kind of global gathering that takes place in Ireland, with a focus on Irish food. But really, I think once you take your own food and examine it, you can start to learn about the nature of everyone's food.
Well, it and you have an amazing reputation. People who know about this conference, and many people know about this conference, have said to me, knowing that I was coming, wonderful things, jealous that they weren't coming themselves. And I've been extremely honored to be here, to be a part of it, to see what you and your team do. It was really been a magical week being here and having the opportunity to do a panel with my Chef Wise book, with you on it, and with Andoni Luis Adariz and Elena Regattas and Tala Bashmi. Thank you for being a part of my book and a part of the panel. Can you share just a little bit about why you asked me coming and talking about Chef Wise here?
I think there's a number of reasons. I think one is certainly I love the format of the book and the openness of the book. And I mean, in a certain way, the book kind of mirrors what we do at Food on the Edge in terms of inviting people and asking them to contribute their time and energy to talk about sustainability or identity or activism or the politics or any of those things. And secondly, I think that the book you published with Fidon, and I did a book with Fidon, and I think for me, and so many speakers who have published Fidon books have come to the conference. And I mean, I love Fidon as a publisher as well, and I think that every time they have said to me, this is someone we did a book with, I think they're interesting. It's always been someone remarkable. So I think they have a great knack of finding chefs and food people around the world who write about food in a really, really beautiful way. And the way they put the books together, they're real testaments to the subject of the book. And so for me, it was very easy to bring you over and get you to talk about the book. And many of the people who participated in the book are past speakers of Food on the Edge. We have Virgilio Martinez and Matt Orlando, two that weren't here this year, but still it kind of captures the spirit of, I think, the spirit of the time. And as I said during the panel, I think it's a good manual for future, I would say future chefs, but also I think for future people in the industry. I think if you're like 15 to 18 year old and you're interested in cooking and you want to know what is happening on the global landscape, I think that your book is a good place to begin. And it's very hard to get all of those conversations if you were to buy those books of all those chefs. And so it's a wonderful little anthology of the kind of zeitgeist of what's happening now.
Well, thank you. It was really an honor to be here and to be a part of. So it was two fantastic days of the symposium, and then I've been here now for 2 days of excursions, which has been quite incredible. Thank you. You brought the conference to Dublin this year. I've heard that you're going to be going back to Galway next year, which is where your restaurant is. You want to talk a little bit about Galway and a little about your restaurant too?
Yeah, I mean, I'm originally from Dublin. I grew up just outside at a place called Maynooth, and I traveled to Galway in 1999 for the summer. And Galway has a wonderful bug that gets into you and under your skin, and it's I spent a summer there, and then I was like, I want to live here. And it has a wonderful kind of bohemian arts culture as a university. It has a great food and restaurant culture, lovely bar culture, and I was just very attracted to it, and very cosmopolitan as well. There's so many people from everywhere. I always say that in Galway, it's very hard to find sometimes a Galwegian in Galway because there's so many people from all over the world, and I love that multicultural aspect. And we opened our first restaurant in Galway, Cava Bodega, which is where we opened in 2008, and then we opened a near restaurant in 2011, and in 2012 it won a Michelin star. And I suppose the near is the flagship of our restaurants. We had another restaurant that we closed during COVID, unfortunately, Tartar. But a near was a small project we began to investigate the possibilities of Irish food in terms of what grew locally, what grew on the island, what wild food was there, what seaweed was there, and to really try and develop a flavour profile of what an Irish cuisine might look like without drawing on food products from elsewhere in the world. So we don't use lemons or black pepper or avocados or olive oil or like many soy sauce or anything like that. And so we did this, and it has taken us a long time, and we're still discovering things. But I think that the kind of signature that we have in an ear is to try and offer people a contemporary vision of Irish food. And many of our customers are from North America, and I think that kind of Irish American diaspora very much appeals to people in North America, because many of them have a connection to Ireland and they want to get a taste of contemporary Irish food. And many of them are in Ireland looking at the wonderful sites such as Newgrange or the Cliffs of Moher or the many other places along the Wild Atlantic Way. And so yeah, we've been incredibly fortunate. I mean, we were closed for 18 months during COVID, and I thought the restaurant would never reopen. And we've been incredibly fortunate since then to welcome back so many people. And we are doing a redesign in January, because we're going to stay another 10 years, hopefully. We've signed another lease, and I hope we will continue to refine and investigate Irish food and inspire younger chefs and younger front of house and restaurateurs to follow us in the same journey.
Amazing. I can't wait to visit whenever that is. I'm definitely coming. And I know we have to get to dinner. We have things to do with the group.
We do indeed.
But before I let you go, would you please play my speed round game?
Okay.
What this is I name a couple of things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Okay.
To give you choices.
Perfect.
Okay. So here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
It's eat in at home or eat out at a restaurant. Yeah. I had to get a little clearer on that during COVID.
Yes, that's true. I do you know what it's very hard, but like I love eating out. I do love cooking as well, but I do love exploring other people's restaurants.
Okay. Indoor dining or al fresco dining?
It depends on the weather, but indoor dining mostly, yes.
Okay. Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Always wine, and it will always be Pinot Noir. That is my go-to drink, and I love exploring the world through Pinot Noirs. I love tasting them all.
Good to know. I was going to say, should I ask, or Guinness, which is obviously beer, but okay.
But anyway, I do have the odd Guinness, and I certainly grew up drinking Guinness, and it is an extremely popular stout. There are many other stouts in Ireland as well, but Guinness is the most popular. But certainly in the last maybe 5 years, I think it's since I had children and I couldn't get to the pub anymore, I got into Pinot Noirs and just started to explore.
Okay. How about tasting menu or a la carte?
I think tasting menu.
Small plates or large plates?
Small plates.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Look, I look communal table.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping.
Fish and chips or Irish stew?
Fish and chips.
Irish soda bread or scones?
Irish soda bread.
Okay. I do not believe I've had some yet. I have to get
really?
Me some.
Really? There has been some.
I haven't realized.
It has been floating around.
Okay.
The kind of brown bread that we've.
The brown bread is that Irish soda bread?
Brown soda bread.
I take it back. I've had it.
Yeah, because I suppose it looked.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just.
I was thinking it was more of a white bread. But,
no,
okay.
You can have a white soda bread, but traditionally. Soda bread in Ireland is brown because of our wonderful rainy weather. And because it's so wet in Ireland, the wheat that we produce is a little bit weaker, not as glutinous. And that's why soda bread, the tradition of soda bread is much more developed in Ireland rather than, say, a sourdough tradition or a yeast tradition. It's the weather. We blame the weather.
Okay, cool. Not like I want to leave, but now I can leave because sometimes you got to, like, off the bucket list.
Absolutely.
Like, you got to check, like, things. Okay, two more. Cheese plate or dessert?
Oh, man, that's a very difficult one. I mean, I love cheese, and Irish cheese is great, but if it's ice cream or if it's tiramisu, that is my favorite dessert. I think I know, actually, funnily enough, my two favorite foods, which is bizarre because people will think all the Irish things is spaghetti bolognese as a meal and tiramisu as a dessert. And it's because the first food that made a massive impression on me when I was young, when I was, maybe 8 or 9, I'm not too sure, it could have been 10. My parents brought me out to a restaurant and I ordered spaghetti bolognese and I thought it was the most magical thing ever. And we had never had pasta in the house up until that point. And my grandparents had never eaten pasta. And I was like, what is this? And I think it gave me an insight into the magic of food, and the food could transport you to places. And because before that, I always felt food was just for eating. And I think that was a little epiphany I had, and I still make it for my daughter. One of the daughters, the other daughter, is not like spaghetti bolognese, unfortunately, but at least one of my daughters is slightly into food, and we enjoy having bolognese.
Amazing. I learned so much in this talk we've had.
Thank you. Last one is
Manhattan, Brooklyn, Dublin, or Galway?
Do you know, if I had to narrow them all down, I do like Brooklyn. I do like Dublin, but I, do you know what? I'd have to say Galway, you know. I mean, I do like Manhattan, and my daughter has some notions of going there and being an actress, but I just, like she said, all the Irish people who are famous live there. But I think it's very hard, you know. Could I take a week in Manhattan and a week in Galway? Maybe. But listen, I'd have to say Galway.
Okay, well, I'm glad you said Galway. Can't wait to visit Galway. Sure. One day. Huge congratulations to you. Like, seriously, I did a conference before the pandemic, a one-day conference, and I got a little taste into what it yes. takes to do this. Yes. And what you do is way more complex, and it's absolutely fantastic. Two full days of programming, amazing speakers from around the world, and just so many other things happening besides what's happening on the stage. A beautiful property. Your whole team has been so extraordinary, lovely to work with. And I just want to say congratulations and keep doing what you're doing. And anything I could do to help, let me know.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
Thank you.
And thank you for letting me be involved in your book as well.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure and honor to have you in ChefWise. So
thank
congratulations.
You.
Thank Brilliant. You.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and this is my special on-the-road show from Food on the Edge, which took place from October 16th to 17th in Dublin, Ireland. I hope you enjoyed all of my interviews. Thank you so much to everyone who took the time to chat with me. It was really lovely to meet all of you, and congratulations on all of your success. And big thank you to everyone just involved in the two-day symposium, 2 days of excursions, everyone who took part in it, everyone who hosted us, who was so welcoming. And thank you to JP and Abigail and Julianne. So wonderful to meet you. I loved it. So it's time for my solo dining experience. This week is at Fish Shop. Here's the rundown. The location, 76 Benburb Street, Smithfield, Dublin, Ireland. The concept, from day one, it has served a daily changing menu of the best locally caught beer battered fish with really lovely wine. The owners, it's a couple, Peter Hogan and Jamoke Akintola Hogan. Why'd I go? Well, I heard from a few trusted sources, including my friend Chadwick Boyd, that this was the best place in town for fish and chips and a must visit. So I had to go. My experience. So I was able to get a reservation for one. I took a car down to the Dublin city center because we were staying a little more in the outskirts. And first I walked around. I was like the center of town. I went by this famous, I guess now touristy spot called the Temple Bar, where there was a lot of Guinness flowing and music playing and good vibes. And it was nice to see Dublin. It has some cobblestone streets and character. There's a canal that runs through, which I walked down or up, I don't know, to get to this restaurant, which is about 15 minutes from the center of town. And when I arrived, it's a small place. It's maybe got 20 seats, if not even. It's mostly a bar with ledge dining. And I was on a counter ledge near the front. So I looked over the menu. I chatted with my server a little bit about what to get. I ordered and enjoyed. So what did I get? Well, of course, I got fish and chips. beer battered catch of the day with chips and tartar sauce. And I chose hake as my fish. There were a couple you could choose from. And then I also got fried calamari with aioli to start. My take, damn good fish and chips. Yes, worth going to as advised. Super fresh, super crispy fried crust, large portion, I would say, piping hot when it came out. Crispy fries or frites or chips, however you want to call them. Yeah, it was great. And I also enjoyed the fried calamari. I mean, can't go wrong with some fried calamari to start. And it was a smaller portion, so it was good for one. So it's an intimate space. It's got a lot of natural light because there's big windows up front, but the space is mostly just a little bar. It's casual, simplistic, some light woods. And again, it has this like ledge seating going around. Perfect for seafood lovers, I'd say solo or with a friend, or there's a takeout option because while I was there, several people came in and placed to-go orders. So if you can't get a reservation, keep that in mind. You can take it out. Interesting tidbit. So the fish shop began in a converted shed with al fresco dining in Black Rock Market in 2013, and it moved to this indoor location in 2015. Personal fun fact. So where else did I dine while in Dublin? Okay, so here's where I went. I went to Woof, which is catty corner from where I was at the fish shop. And I had an Irish breakfast. I sat outside, actually. The sun came out and I had my jacket on, but it was nice enough to sit outside. It wasn't super cold. I stopped by a place called Bread 41 and had a second brunch. They're known for their bread. They had bread at our conference, which was amazing because I got to try lots of different styles they had, and it was all excellent. I went by Marco Pierre White Steakhouse and Grill. I had some steak frites and onion soup and Eton mess. All great. I'd never been to a Marco Pierre White restaurant, so I wanted to go while I could. I also went to Library Street, and I met Chef Kevin Burke and his team. This place was also highly recommended to me by several people, including Jack McGarry of the Dead Rabbit in New York City, who's from Ireland. And it was nice because I went there, I threw out Jack's name and we had an instant connection and the team was so lovely. And they sent me out a couple of things that I had more food than I could eat, but it was all delicious. I had spatchcock quail, I had some snacks, I had cabbage, I had an amazing Paris breast for dessert, really outstanding. I got to chat with Kevin a little bit. And yeah, I was really glad I got to go there and squeeze it into this trip. And I also got to squeeze in going to Chapter One, which is a 2-Michelin-star tasting menu restaurant. No, I don't know how I find the time to do this either, but that was great. I went bar hopping too, as one does. I went to the Vintage Cocktail Club, which is speakeasy that on the door, it just has VCC outside. So you kind of got to know where it is and find it. And then you go upstairs, it's got this like swanky cocktail club. I had a nice non-alcoholic drink there. And then I also went to Bar 1661, which a few people recommended. And Jack McGarry had done a collaboration with them at the Dead Rabbit for their holiday pop-up last year, which I had actually gone to. So I got to meet part of their team, one of the bartenders, David George, was there, and we connected through this relationship with Jack. And also give a shout-out to Kim, known as the restaurant enabler, who gave me a bunch of tips on places to go, and she was friendly with them as well. And I had an awesome non-alcoholic drink called the Charlie. So that was great. I'm probably missing some stuff, but that's the gist of where I ate and drank while in Dublin, and it was all really great. So the cost of my meal was 27 euro. This is going back to Fish Shop. And would I go back? Yes. And their website is fish-shop.ie and on Instagram at fishshopbenburb. And that's the show. Thank you so much again to JP McMahon, Abigail Coleron, Julianne Faherty, and the entire team of Food on the Edge for having me, for hosting this symposium, which was extraordinary, and the 2 days of excursions around Dublin. It was really a treat to be a part of, and I appreciate all of you, and congratulations on everything. I hope to be back in the future and come to Food on the Edge in Galway. Thank you also to all of the outstanding chefs on our ChefWise panel. Again, it was just an honor to be on stage with you and have you as contributors to my book. And that includes JP McMahon, Andoni Luis Adariz, Elena Regadas, and Tala Bashmi. Thank you to everyone who spoke with me on this show: Alessandro Cozzolino, Endo Kazutoshi, Rich Shi, Tom Jenkins, Arlene Stein, Andrea Petrini, Jason Bangerter, and JP McMahon. I will include in our show notes who everyone is so you can find out more about them and more about Food on the Edge. Their website is foodontheedge.ie and on Instagram at Food on the Edge and hashtag FOTE2023. You can find me on Instagram at Sherry Bayer, at Bayer PR, and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllintheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Check out my new book, ChefWise, Life Lessons from Leading Chefs Around the World by Fiden, now available wherever books are sold. Many thanks to my engineer today, Armin. I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bayer. Stay tuned for more on-the-road episodes from my culinary travels. Stay safe and well, and thank you, as always, for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.